Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
The Breakdown is sponsored by the Soundtrack of America, Made in Tennessee. And one of the things we love to do in this show is trace back the roots of bluegrass music to the places it came from. One of those places is the charming city of Bristol, high up in the mountains where Tennessee meets Virginia. It's here producer Ralph Peer recorded the famous Bristol Sessions, introducing Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family to the world. And you can learn all about its rich cultural heritage at the Birthplace of Country Music Museum, part of Tennessee Music Pathways, a statewide program that preserves the legacy of music in Tennessee. If you want to visit the places that inspired so many of the records we talk about on this podcast, check out tnvacation.com to start planning your trip. And now, on with the show. Hello, and welcome to The Breakdown, the podcast that uncovers the greatest sounds and stories in bluegrass music, one iconic record at a time.
I'm Patrick McGonigal, the fiddle player with the Lonely Heartstring Band.
And I'm Emma John, author, journalist, and all-round bluegrass novice. Today we're talking about Seldom Seen's Live at the Cellar Door. It's a complete romp of an album, recorded live in Washington, D.C. in 1975. The Seldom Seen were so named because they were made up of four musicians who had absolutely no intention of going on the road. John Starling on guitar, Ben Eldridge on banjo, Tom Gray on bass, and of course, the legendary John Duffy on mandolin. It was Duffy's second band, really, wasn't it, Patrick?
It was. It was his second band. It was the band that, as you said, would never tour because the first band, Country Gentlemen, toured too much for John.
And he'd basically retired from the Country Gentlemen because he'd had enough and ended up jamming with some friends in Ben Eldridge's basement and forming this band.
He was like, well, we're going to play the music we want to play and say names like Eric Clapton from stage at a bluegrass show. But meanwhile, we're not going to try to tour. We're not going to try to get booked at Carlton Haney's festivals. We're just going to do our own thing, and we're going to play a weekly gig for 20-plus years and play whatever we want. And the record proves it. I love how they play whatever they want. They play songs that the Grateful Dead made famous. They play Will the Circle Be Unbroken. They just unabashedly play whatever they want, knowing that Bill Monroe probably hated it.
I didn't realise that the Cellar Door was not one of their regular gigs. They had these two other famous regular gigs. One of them was at the Red Fox Inn in Bethesda, Maryland. And the other one was at the Birchmere in Virginia, in Alexandria, Virginia. The Cellar Door wasn't one of their weekly gigs, but they liked the venue, apparently. And they thought it would... I think they did a Christmas show. I did talk to both Tom Gray and Ben Eldridge about this album. And I think Tom Gray told me that this was a sort of annual gig that they did at the Cellar Door. And they realised it would probably make for a good live album.
I had never really listened to the band much beyond peripherally hearing the Seldom Scene. And so this is kind of my first exposure to the band. And one of the things that struck me about this record is just how enthusiastic the audience is. They lose their minds after every song and after every solo. And from the sounds of things, it sounds like it's an all-female audience. There are particularly, I think, a couple women in the audience that just freak out after every solo and every song. And I feel like that just drives the energy of the whole recording. As much as a crazy John Duffy solo, it's also these amazing women just loving every note.
I love that you've picked up on that, partly because I'm not sure whether it's women or just one woman. And also partly because, and I think we should introduce this here, Tom Gray told me the secret of that scream.
You've heard there's a screaming female voice that is heard on that live recording. Well, our engineer friend who recorded all of this and put together the package that is the Live at the Cellar Door album, he kept reusing that same scream. You can hear it in there, you know, just showing that, you know, people were having a good time in there. It's interesting that 20 years later, a woman came to me and said, "I am the one who was screaming in the cellar door." I said, "Oh, that's you."
One of the things that a lot of people complain about the album, they say they love the actual songs and the tracks, but they, you know, they don't like the screaming and it's too much for them.
What? That's like one of the coolest parts about it, because I feel like it drives the energy so hard, because, you know, if you've stopped paying attention to this record for like 30 seconds and then you hear some woman go, "Ah!" your attention is immediately drawn back in. You cannot put this on quietly during a dinner party.
Yeah, you're right. It's not a soundtrack to my dinner with Andre. For sure.
It's also, I mean, as I kind of mentioned before, it's such a great record as kind of a time capsule for the bluegrass industry at that moment, because they are encapsulating so much of what was happening in bluegrass and kind of the larger conversation about bluegrass in general that still happens, because this record, they just toe the line between rock and roll and jam band, kind of like this is before jam grass is a thing, and yet the last track on the record is an 8-minute jam song, and they play songs that the Grateful Dead were playing. They really hit on the pop songs, but then they play Rawhide, and they play a bunch of Bill Monroe songs, and they play a bunch of kind of like showy instrumentals. And I think part of what makes this record so high up in the bluegrass mythology is just that, you know, the record says more than 1,000 words ever could about bluegrass music.
I think you would really like to hear what Tom Gray says about how they chose these songs. The simple truth is, they didn't.
Let me clarify something. There never was a set list for the Seldom Scene. We wanted it to be spontaneous. Anytime we went on stage, we would plan the first two, maybe three songs, and just wing it from there. We'd talk to each other and say, "What do you want? What do you want to do? An old bluegrass?" "Yeah, I would do Bill Monroe tune, sing of My Little Georgia Rose, or a pop tune." And of course, John Starling, being the lead singer, would choose much of the material. He sought new songs from songwriters, and on that Cellar Door album, he rode all the way to Texas. We had never played that on stage before. We had just worked it out in the back room, and this is something that John Starling suggested to do, and that night, he said, "Let's sing all the way to Texas.
He rode all the way to Texas on an old freight train. He's letting you know he's the moving kind.
It also just is the sound of the 70s bluegrass scene. I mean, I always think about the sound of 70s being Sonny Osborne and Ben Eldridge's banjo playing. It's just such a sound. It's very like bright and kind of bell-like and almost, I hate to say the word clangy because it's not clangy. It's just like very in your face. But it's that banjo sound combined with tons and tons of chords.
Pioneers before us were all country people. They were all from the South. And their music appealed to some of us people who grew up in cities. And John Duffy felt from the start, there are a lot of people like me in these cities, and we should play our music to them. We will never be able to relate to all those people who grew up on farms or had been coal miners for their lives, like so many of the early bluegrass pioneers. He said, we're city people. We should play our music to other city people.
John Duffy, also, aside from being a great mandolin player and singer and all-round in-your-face loud guy, was a great instrument repair person. He was a luthier and a staple in the kind of central East Coast music scene for being the guy to put your guitar back together.
They all had their own day jobs, didn't they? Mike Aldridge was a graphic designer. Tom Gray was a cartographer for National Geographic. John Starling, he was an ear, nose and throat doctor and had seen service as an army surgeon in Vietnam. Ben Eldridge was a mathematician, and he met John Starling while they were both at the University of Virginia. That's how they came to end up playing together. And he told us a little bit about that.
Mike and I were pretty much the same age. We were both born in 38, and I was born in August, and he was born, I believe, in December. Mike and I were two, you know, closest in age to each other.
We had just a little basement band. We never went out to play anywhere. We just would come over my house on Monday nights. Everybody would get there about 7:30, 7:45, and we'd go down to my basement and pick. We just play, and we had never had any, idea of, going out and doing it in front of people. But John was a legend at that point. We were just, we were just basement pickers, the rest of us. But I'd gotten to know John I was teaching banjo in a music store, and he had a little repair shop across the hall, and I'd gotten to know him. Anyway, we thought we'd give him a call, see if he'd be interested in doing a band. And I'll never forget, Starling was in my kitchen, and we called Duff to see if he'd be interested. And of course, none of us thought he would, we were worthy of playing with John. but anyway, I remember Starling telling him that, John, would you be interested in doing something like this? And I was listening to the conversation, and I was expecting to hear Starling say, well, that's all right. We just thought we'd see if you're interested. And instead, what I heard was, oh, yeah, well, maybe we can get together next Monday or Tuesday night and go over some tunes. And I freaked out, man. I thought, wow.
John liked to sing with other good singers. And John Starling was perhaps going to be the key to getting John Duffy to want to play and sing again. And so that is how the band that became the Seldom Seen got started, when finally they persuaded John Duffy to go to a jam, and he felt, this is fun. I could enjoy playing with these people.
Sing my love through loneliness. Sing my love through sorrow. I'll give you my loneliness. Come and give me your tomorrow.
Early on, we would get together with John. John Duffy hated the practice. And so John Starling's wife, Faisu, was a real good singer and real good, you know, she could hear harmonies and stuff. Like, she, you know, she, all she had to do is hear a song once and she'd pick it up. So what we would do, we would just go up to Starling's house and down to my house without Duffy and, you know, work on songs, work on the harmonies. And Faisu would, you know, she would be singing the part that Duff would normally do. She would be singing tenor. And then when the rest of us learned a song, we'd get together with Duff. And of course, all he had to do was hear it once or twice, and he'd have the part all worked out.
There were differences between John Starling and John Duffy, their approach to singing. John Duffy wanted to sing loud and strong and high. John Starling wanted to be less forceful, but sound more intimate. And at one time, John Starling was trying to persuade John Duffy to sing not so loud and strong. Let your voice be a little more airy, even. Use falsetto when you hit those high notes. And John Duffy looked at him and said, you be you and I'll be me.
The way that they match their vowel sounds in their harmonies, they sound like one voice. It's really hard sometimes to tell, like, is this two voices or three voices or four voices? Because it's so blended and their articulations are the same. And the way that they'll move dynamically in one syllable, one word, from huge and open and loud to all of a sudden super quiet and closed, all together, all locked in, song after song after song.
Now the truth has dawned, and it's plain enough to see that the whole world knew, with a small exception of me. That the whole world, with a small exception of me.
They will make these little musical signatures with their voices, yeah, that finish off songs in a way that no, it just was not part of bluegrass. It was not something that was part of the Bill Monroe or the Flat and Scruggs style. The one on The Small Exception of Me is now, I think, that is, yeah, now the official way to sing that song. You know,
yeah, for sure.
Even though that was originally a Dean Martin song.
Right.
It's like, eat your heart out, Dean Martin. Seldom Seen have got this.
Now the truth is done, and it's plain enough to see that the whole world knew, with a small exception of me.
Meanwhile, they put a vocal tag a cappella on the front of My Little Georgia Rose, Bill Monroe's tune, which I'm sure he would have again been very upset about, but they put their stamp right in the front of that song.
Not just the stamp at the front. What about the modulation? That's the thing that I think would have had Bill absolutely spinning on the spot. A modulation in a bluegrass tune?
In a Bill Monroe tune. That's why I feel like a lot of their bluegrass is so tongue-in-cheek.
We don't sing old songs again.
It's great bluegrass. They are playing it. They're slaying it. The traditionalists would absolutely love it. But there's a certain sense of caricature, like in Hit Parade of Love, the Jimmy Martin classic. They just sound like Jimmy Martin. They play it exactly like Jimmy Martin, to the effect that when Ben Eldridge decides to take somewhat of a melodic style kind of modern banjo solo, the whole band starts heckling him on stage.
It's a total spoof, isn't it?
Yeah.
They even bark the way that Jimmy Martin barks.
Green love, I know I'll never stop. I got a long, long way to climb for me to tap. Bam! If I do get there sooner than we had it made, then I'll love number one, you'll ever see parade.
Hit Parade of Love is the one where Ben drops his pick, isn't it?
Right, yeah.
Which I think is possibly one of the most famous moments of this album. It might be one of the most well-known things about The Seldom Seen.
Yeah,
it's not actually anything to do with the music. It's just the fact that in the middle of the solo he drops his pick.
That was me. That happened. It was probably about 1 o'clock in the morning. We were probably all a little bit over-adjusted, to put it that way, on our last set. And I just got carried away. My pick fell off my finger while I was playing the lead on the banjo. And then, of course, John made a big deal out of it on the record. All that was happening fairly late in the evening, as I recall. And then, of course, the crazier the audience got, the crazier we got.
The Cellador is a very small venue. I think it had a capacity of 163 or something like that. And I do think it sounds like at every point on the album, you can hear every single one of the 163 people individually.
I feel like they had as many mics pointed back at the audience as they did at the band. I never find the heckling annoying. And even the way that the band responds to the heckling by acknowledging it and replying to it, that's like number one no-no from stage. If you start responding to hecklers, you're just opening a can of worms. But they're respectful. I don't find them chirping up in the middle of songs, but they just kind of, they jump in and holler where I would jump in and holler, and I appreciate that. And in the quiet songs, it's pin drop quiet. I mean, maybe that's an engineering thing, but it also creates a vibe of like, oh, this is the moment when we're really quiet. And they don't, for like the sad songs, they don't whoop and scream and holler. They have this very like kind of contemplative, I don't know, they really reflect the album to me.
I always found the second half of the album less interesting. I would quite often switch off after Small Exception of Me because that's one of my favourites. And I was like, yeah, I've got everything I wanted to out of this listen. But the more I've listened to the last few songs, the more I found some of them unbearably moving. I feel like White Line is a really good example of one that's just, you know, you just don't expect.
Cold and lonely on the road, Lord, I wish I had a hill to climb. Summer's warm rain sure ain't coming, so it seems to me I'm falling. once again.
That song was written by Willie P. Bennett, who was a Canadian mandolin player and guitar player and songwriter, and just lived on the road his whole life. And he's a Canadian legend, and he played a lot with a well-known Canadian rocker named Fred Eaglesmith. But he died in 2008. Essentially, what killed him was the road. He had addiction issues and alcohol issues, and he just lived a really hard-driving, live-fast-die-hard kind of life. But he wrote a lot of really beautiful and pensive songs like this one, which is clearly just a song. I mean, White Line speaks to, you know, drug culture as much as it speaks to highway culture, and just kind of the song about being road weary and tired, and, you know, and knowing Willie's story. It's a real song. It's a real song about a real lived experience.
Standing by a midnight highway, excuse me, sir, you're going my way. On and on the endless white line goes.
There's some other tracks that have sad backstories as well, aren't there, on this album? City of New Orleans.
Yeah.
Which is actually one of my favorite songs, and I only came across it because of this album. I hadn't known about the Arlo Guthrie version or the Willie Nelson version in 84, which won a Grammy Award. The only one I had heard was Seldom Seen doing it. And it's just beautiful.
Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central Monday morning rail. Got 15 cars, 15 restless riders, 3 conductors, 25 sacks of mail.
I am a person who loves a train journey, so perhaps it was always going to speak to me. But it also has a slightly sad backstory because it was written by Steve Goodman, who found out that he had leukemia at the age of 20. And
wow.
He was a classmate of Hillary Clinton at the time at college. But he, when he discovered that he had this illness and that it wasn't going to go away, he left college to just play music full time. And he had 16 years of being a full-time musician and then died at 36.
Singing good morning, America, how are you? Yeah, don't you know me, I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans, and I'll be gone 500 miles when day is done.
John and I were, I don't know, we were listening to something on the radio one night, I think, just riding in the car, and they played it. They played Steve Goodman's version of it. And we went over to the record store the next day and bought the album. Met him one time over at Faisu's house and picked a couple of songs with him. And he was just a sweet, nice guy.
My drifting memory goes back to the spring of 43, when I was just a child in mama's arms. My daddy plowed the ground and prayed that someday he might leave this rundown mortgaged Oklahoma farm.
You mentioned how so much of this album encapsulates the sound of the 70s. I wonder if that is what I'm thinking of when I listen to California Cotton Fields, which is one of my favorite tracks on this album. I think John Starling's singing is so smooth and sexy, yeah, and gorgeous.
Yeah.
But I also really, really love the storytelling and the words of the song. I find it incredibly touching. And there's a line in the chorus that's repeated, when labor camps were filled with worried men with broken dreams. But to me, that sounds like it's got a real touch of the Simon and Garfunkel about it.
California cotton fields, when labor camps were filled with worried men with broken dreams. California cotton fields, as close to wealth as daddy ever came.
I mean, it's a great John Starling style, because the songs that he does write, like he wrote All the Way to Texas and CNO Canal, are kind of storytelling songs. He's really, as you say, he does have a great way of delivering the stories.
John Starling was
he was very intense when he was working out the way he was going to sing a song. He didn't just stand up and sing a song that he'd heard someone else sing or that somebody had given him the words to a song and said, hey, sing this. He wanted to work out just how he was going to sing every note. Was he going to slide into it? Was he going to explode onto a word, a note, places where there were harmonies? Would he want to pounce on it? He would plan how he would say every word and sing every note.
Hey, 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 Lockery. Oh, hey, hey,
Lockery. CNO Canal. That's another beautiful, soft kind of song. That's very Gordon Lightfoot.
Did you see that that was actually written to go with a TV documentary?
Yeah, they mentioned it in the recording, but I didn't know anything about the documentary itself.
It was called Perspective, When the Past Dries Up, and it was a TV film that was made about the CNO Canal, also known as the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal, also apparently sometimes known as the Grand Old Ditch, which is a 19th century man-made waterway that runs 185 miles from the Potomac River via West Virginia to Maryland. And it used to take barges carrying coal from the Allegheny Mountains.
Up from a night in a shady saloon, he remembers the night of the boatman's tunes. It's all a part of the boatman's soul, as the smell of the dust of the Cumberland coal.
We need to talk about Tom Gray's bass playing on this record. It's one of the things that, in my naivete, really stuck out to me, having not listened to a bunch of Seldom Seen. What an amazing bass player he was.
In North Carolina, for the best bass player in bluegrass music.
I mean, he is so not traditional in the way that he plays the bass. His whole solos are just walking. He's a phenomenal walking bass player. Small Exception of Me is another great example. His bass playing is like, it's almost like he's the featured instrumentalist on that track. It's like he's doing all the fills, and yet he's the bass player, and he's still holding down the bass. I don't know. I was just in love with his bass playing the entire record.
I first met John Duffy when he played with a band called Lucky Chapman and the Ozark Mountain Boys or something like that. And I remember seeing John Duffy, that big guy with the mandolin, who had an air about him that he obviously felt superior to everyone else. A lot of people have gotten that impression of John and his attitude. Anyway, I got to know John. Despite his airs about him, he did become a friendly person and supportive person to me in my career. I had been going to see the Country Gentlemen in the club where they played and got quite familiar with all of the members in the band. I remember when Eddie Adcock first joined the Country Gentlemen, they would ask me to get up and play a few songs with them. Then I was asked to join the Gentlemen when I was still 19 years old. Gosh, that was 60 years ago. They were both in the contemporary side of bluegrass at the time, but the sound of the band was different. The Seldom Scene was smoother. It featured the dobro of Mike Aldridge. Mike played with such a pretty tone, and John Starling, being the lead singer, had such a smooth voice that I needed to play less aggressively than I did with the country gentlemen, who were kind of artistically looser.
You must leave, take what you need, if best. Whatever you wish to keep, you better grab it fast. Yonder stands your orphan with his gun, crying like a fire in the sun.
It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, famous Bob Dylan song. By the time the Seldom Scene do it on this album, everyone has covered this song, including the Byrds and the Country Gentlemen, which is presumably why it gets done again. And as you said, Tom Gray already has this amazing walking bass part. Well, Tom Gray was in the Country Gentlemen with Duffy before he joined the Seldom Scene. And if you listen to the Country Gentlemen's version of this song, you'll notice it's very similar.
Oh, really? It's the same walking bass line.
It's got the same kickoff. It's got a very similar groove. It's got very similar timing. The one thing that's different, they took it up a tone.
Oh, they took it up a tone for the Seldom Scene.
Yeah. So John Duffy obviously thinks, I was already singing pretty high on the tenor. Let's see how high I can go.
And I read this morning that he had four octaves that he could sing. He had a register of four octaves, which is kind of unheard of. I mean, it makes sense. Some of those notes that he hits on this record are crazy high. But it also makes sense because his dad, John Duffy Humbird Sr., was in the chorus at the Metropolitan Opera and was a highly trained and very successful opera singer. And apparently, as a child, John Duffy spent a lot of time with his dad doing breathing exercises and vocal technique to really get that high register. So it would make sense that he, wants to flex his throat muscles, I guess, and take it up a notch.
Strike another match, go start anew. It's all over now, baby. It's all over now, baby blue.
And I think that's part of what makes this such a moving performance, is that really high, piercing, almost vibrato-less performance. It's just, it's devastating. I would say that's, if I had to pick one track, that might be it. I also think it's interesting that they do Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Because it's, of course, the title song of maybe the most popular, and I say popular in terms of like the genre of pop music, it's the most popular record of that kind of era in bluegrass. It's what really drew Maybelle Carter and Doc Watson and Jimmy Martin and of course the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band into this really public mainstream.
I was standing by my window on one cold and cloudy day when I saw the hearse come rolling.
they've clearly listened to the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band version, because a lot of the inflections are replicated here. But the thing that saves this one for me is the Mike Aldridge's dobro playing. He does gorgeous fills, and he's got a tone and a taste that's just next level. And I, throughout this whole record, listening to the dobro really made me realize more than ever how much he defines the sound of the dobro.
I love the dobro playing on Dark Hollow. It's doing such interesting things under the mandolin during the intro.
Whenever he's playing underneath someone, he never steps on the toes. I feel like that's why he the dobro and bass on this record work so well, because they can both play exactly what they want all the time, but they never step on anyone else.
I'd rather be in some dark hollow where the sun don't never shine, than to be all alone and far away from home. It would cause me to lose my mind.
Mike, at first, was a banjo player. He was attracted to this music that was to become known as bluegrass. And at first, there was no dobro in it, of course. But he was so excited when Flat and Scruggs hired Josh Graves to be a dobro player. This is something Mike had always wanted to do. He wanted to be like his uncle, Ellsworth Cousins. Ellsworth Cousins had played the slide guitar with Jimmy Rogers in 1929. This was before the dobro had been invented. Ellsworth just took a guitar and set it on his lap with a high nut, played it with a bar, like a Hawaiian guitar was known in those days. So Mike said to me in one of our jam sessions, when Mike was playing a banjo, he said, "Did you hear that new sound of Flat and Scruggs? They have a dobro. I'm going to get one. I'm going to play that." Mike befriended Josh Graves, who played that dobro with Flat and Scruggs. And Josh helped Mike acquire his first dobro.
So blow your whistle, freight train. Carry me farther on down the track. Well, I'm going away. I'm leaving today. I'm going, but I ain't coming back.
And the other thing that you get in Dark Hollow is Duffy's mandolin tremolo.
And I kind of feel like the Duffy mandolin solo that kind of captures Duffy's mandolin playing better than any other single solo is his solo on Old Gray Bonnet. It's a three-part solo, and the first third, he just scrubs the whole time in his classic rushed way. You know, you listen to someone like David Grisman play tremolo, and it's like these perfect sort of triplet patterns. Duffy's just throwing his hand at that mandolin and scrubbing as hard as he can. And the second part of that solo, the second third, is this kind of melodic, you could even say Monroe-y, but the mandolin kind of sounds out of tune, and it's very kind of Duffy. It's like, is it Monroe-y? Is it just kind of walking all over the mandolin? And then the third, he just all of a sudden flicks a switch, and he's just playing total blues. It's like minor thirds and minor sevenths, and it's like rock and roll guitar solo, and he even bends the mandolin strings, for one note. So within one solo, you have him doing his three distinct styles of mandolin playing. And then all of a sudden, the very next track, CNO Canal, he takes a solo, and it could be Jesse McReynolds. The whole thing is just a cross-picking solo. So I think in that 8 minutes of music, you have John Duffy showing off that he can do anything on the mandolin. It's going to be dirty. It's not going to be tight and cleaned up like the people he's imitating or hearkening to, but he can do it all.
And it is a really random old tune. It's from 1909, and it's a rag composed by a notable rag writer called Percy Wenrich, who came from Joplin, Missouri. I feel like Joplin is a very good town to come from if you write ragtime.
I know you rider gonna miss me when I'm gone. Gonna miss your baby from rolling in your arms.
I would like to talk about the last track on this record, Rider. This is one that, you know, I keep talking about how this record encapsulates so much. But this one, I mean, I first was introduced to this song as a teenager, as a Grateful Dead fan, because the Grateful Dead recorded this over and over in so many live recordings. But I would say most famously on the Live from Europe in 1972 record, which is, I don't know, up there in their top five most famous records. And they always coupled this song with their hit China Cat Sunflower, which is a Robert Hunter lyric tune, a classic Dead song. And then they would do I Know You Rider, and Jerry would sing the crap out of it. But in this one, they're clearly tipping their hat to the Grateful Dead because they take crazy extended solos. Especially again, John Duffy, he takes a solo where he kind of stops in the middle and somebody says, "Hey, John, where'd that lick come from?" And he says, "I just invented it."
"7 minutes is all it was. It used to go, sometimes it would go 15 minutes. You know, we'd get crazy with it. And actually, there are a lot of, it was fun to play, but I think we sort of overdid it.
You want to hear Eric Clapton?
But it's an interesting song. It was a song that is mostly traceable to the blues guitar player, blind blues guitar player, Blind Lemon Jefferson, who recorded it in 1927. So it's also attributed to a recording made by Alan and John Lomax. And I couldn't find out anything more about who the singer was beyond that she was an incarcerated African-American woman, 18 years old, in jail for murder. And she just sang one verse, and then they coupled, Alan and John Lomax coupled the rest together. And then, of course, in the 60s, Grateful Dead played it, and Joan Baez and the Kingston Trio and Janis Joplin and James Taylor and Judy Roderick and Hot Tuna and the Byrds. And then, of course, the seldom seen.
Gonna miss your baby from rolling in your arms.
Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, the song scene.
That's the end of the show. And it's also the end of this series. We really hope you've enjoyed it. We have very much enjoyed chatting to all the amazing musicians who kindly spent time with us in Nashville and throughout Tennessee. And thank you to our sponsor, the Soundtrack of America, made in Tennessee. Don't forget to check out tnvacation.com to start planning your trip now.